Sunday, January 31st, 2010, Rabbi Yehuda Sarna, Orthodoxy and the New College Experience.
Sarna will be talking about Orthodoxy and the New College Experience. Essentially, he's going to share with us his perspective from his experience as to what young college students are facing nowadays in the secular college campus. He and his wife, Michelle, are the educators for the Jewish Learning Initiative on campus, and you have literature associated with that. It's a program of the Orthodox Union. And he's been quite successful at NYU. The Orthodox community has tripled in size since he came. He heads the Jewish Learning Fellowship, which offers 10-week courses on Jewish thought for students without a yeshiva background. And there are 200 students a year in that program. And these accomplishments have already, at his young age, resulted in his being awarded an Exemplar of Excellence Award from Hillel International. And he's listed as one of the under 36 change makers by the Jewish Week in 2009. So he's a person to keep your eyes on. The Shir is sponsored by Debbie Pine and Mark Orenshine, and by Linda and Rabbi Michael Schmidman. There'll be time for questions and answers afterwards. I give you Rabbi Yehuda Sarna. Thank you.
But in any event, my thanks to the sponsors. Is it in honor of someone or memory of someone?
Yes,
my father. So this memory should be blessed. It's a pleasure for me to be here. You know, as I walked in, I see some familiar faces, some yeshiva friends, shy, some parents of students who are either at NYU or Cooper Union. And some friends to be. So thank you for having me tonight. I'm very excited by this opportunity. I grew up in Montreal in a neighborhood that was probably, 90% Jewish or something like that. And I went to a yeshiva day school, yeshiva high school, spent a few years in yeshiva in Israel, and then I went to yeshiva university. As an alum, I'm even carrying a yeshiva university And for the past 8 years, my wife and I have been living in Greenwich Village, working at NYU. Now, it's not exactly a typical existence for an Orthodox rabbi couple. We live in a college dorm on the intersection of 23rd Street and 3rd Avenue. It's us, we have 4 children. Our 2 oldest girls are in Beit Yaakov on the Lower East Side. And then we have a 3-year-old son and a six-month-old son. And so it's us on the second floor and 1,000 sophomores in this 20-story building. And so we're deeply, deeply immersed in diversity at this point. The dorm counselor is an Asian American from California. There's only a few other staff people in the building. One is a gay couple. One of them teaches in the university. The other is a lesbian couple who just had their first child. And then, of course, on the third floor is the imam, the Muslim chaplain of the university. So that's the society that I live in. So at this point, when I first came to NYU, part of me wanted to go because I was, having been at Yeshiva University, I didn't exactly have that diverse experience, and I was kind of looking for my own college experience. Well, I found it and more. What I'd like to do with you tonight is to describe in the different ways that I see, from my perspective, kind of immersed, really immersed within the college experience for the past 7 or 8 years, what I see as the challenges for students coming from an Orthodox background in a secular college environment. I'd like to discuss also the opportunities. And lastly, I want to discuss, I'm guessing that there are parents here in the room whose son or daughter are either approaching the college years or are actually in college now. Am I right about that? Okay, I got some nods. That's good. And I'd like to share some thoughts with you and really be here to answer your question. I just got back today from the United Arab Emirates.
No.
I spent the weekend in Abu Dhabi. NYU is opening a campus there. And I got to tell you about that in a little bit.
Yeah.
But I just came back this afternoon. I went home, told my kids about it, and I came here. So I got that on the brain a little bit. It's much warmer there than it is here. I tell you, the best experience was when I was in the airport in Abu Dhabi. The university flies its employees business class. I was in the business class lounge, and then I hear from behind me someone comes up and says, "Muslim ha." And I couldn't believe it. I turn around, and so there's a stewardess. I say, "Baruch Hashem," and she says, "They come to the first class lounge." I guess it's not terrible to be Jewish in the UAE at least now. It's not in the airport. Okay, more on that later. Let me tell you a bit about my own experience, and through my own experience, what we can learn about the experience of an Orthodox college student. When I was first hired several years ago, it's fresh out of Smicha, and Michelle and I were excited to work at a university. We wanted to be with students at a time in their life when they were making their most important decisions. Michelle especially, myself also, but we're very committed to the spiritual value of personal growth, always wanting to develop ourselves. And we thought if we could be in an environment where others, where even though they're younger than us, but they're also thinking about what are their priorities in their life, what are their values, that would also be enhancing for us. We would have an opportunity to impact them in a way which was truly unique. We were first hired because the Hillel, Hillel is a pluralistic organization, supports all denominations, sensed that the Orthodox community was going to grow. And the students, they were pushing to have a rabbi who they felt that they was one of theirs. And we applied, and we got the job, and we moved down there. When I first got there, my experience of the Orthodox students was that they wanted a rabbi, get this, they wanted a rabbi because they felt like they needed to build the infrastructure of the Orthodox community. And so they had a space which they could call a shul, but there's a piece of furniture called a rabbi that they didn't yet have in the shul. And so they needed someone to like sit up there and say the Bar Torah, and it was a little disjunctive with the interest that Michelle and I had of coming and wanting to be a part of their life. And actually, it took a few months to try to work with them so they understood that the model of rabbi that they were kind of used to from their shul, perhaps, where the rabbi kind of sits up front, is their parents' rabbi but maintains a kind of distance from them, was not the kind that we were looking for. We wanted to be there for them in their own life. Our work in the beginning was setting up shiurim, finding out what exactly their interests were. And this is very much, if you open your folders, this is very much the work of many of the JLIC rabbis. JLIC is the Jewish Learning Initiative on campus. And what it does, the program of the OU, is placing rabbis' families, like Michelle and myself, on college campuses across the country. And as you can tell from the list of colleges there, there are different kinds. You know, there's some which have very large Orthodox communities, some which are very small. There's some which are in the New York area. There's some which are more distant. There are some which where the rabbi is working in concert with other rabbis in the area, and there are others where the rabbi is like a lone gunner. And if you look at, and there's this one page here, I thought they did this so well. On the left-hand side, the back two pages, you see where it says hallmarks of JLIC methodology. Take that out for a second. Do you see that? You can have mine. Here it says relationship building.
there are 5 points here, and that's, and this was information when the Shlomo first got down. It wasn't yet, the first rabbis had just been sent out. And this was kind of the best kind of analysis that we could do of what role does the rabbi fill? And this is what we found, relationship building. That's developing one-on-one relationships with as many students as possible. Two is Jewish learning programs and activities. Third is developing the infrastructure, for example, at NYU, together with Yeshiva University and some local shuls. We built an Eruv in the neighborhood, work on getting better kosher food, work on holiday policies, things like that. Fourth, oh my God, I didn't notice that. Fourth is a picture of myself and my wife. And not that we're models or whatever. And particularly the modeling that happens is through the home. We still have guests every Shabbat for lunch. We have about 20 guests every Shabbat. We're there every Shabbat. Don't ask me how it happens. My wife, I think that she likes the candles. She welcomes in the superpowers. I don't know how it works. But, and then student leadership. Then if you work with a board of student leaders, if you work with a board of student leaders, but there aren't any good student leaders, so we try to make some. We try to reach out so that it's not just the same group or the same type who are there all the time. We try to get a diversity of representation for the Orthodox student community. So what I just described to you is the basic function of a rabbi and rabbanit on a college campus. And again, it's only on these campuses that JLIC has this program. And after a few years, we started noticing some trends as to what happens to students who come from an Orthodox background in a secular college environment. And we identified basically three trends. Two, which describe a minority, and then there's the majority. Here's what I found. Here are my three categories. One I would call the conscientious objectors. Second category I would call the lonely men or lonely women of faith. And the third I would call, for lack of a better term, the Orthodox bourgeois. And I'll tell you about, let me tell you about these three classes. First is the conscientious objectors. This is the group that everybody's afraid of, the ones who go off the derech, the ones who decide, say, don't want to participate anymore, not just in ritual observance, but in the community as a whole. Now, what I started noticing is that, first of all, this group was in the far minority, at least in my own experience at NYU and in conversation with other JLIC rabbis on other campuses. But the other thing I started noticing as I reached out to these students and speaking to them, trying to understand where they're coming from, is that many of them had had previous negative experiences either with rabbis or with their parents. In other words, with authoritative figures. I can't tell you the number of students within this category who were on this path because they felt that rabbis in their previous experiences were overly judgmental, were overly closed-minded. Some were disenchanted with religion because rabbis who had taught them were later accused or indicted of not such great things. These things had a major, major impact. Major impact. I know there's this book called Off the Derech. I only read the opening chapter, I'm not going to lie. But I think her thesis is basically like this, that it's a disenchantment with authoritative figures which prompts people to go off the derech. Let me give you one story. There was a student who was dating someone who was not Jewish. She later converted, but that's a different story. But I started to get to know him. I was concerned about him. And he said when he was in a particular yeshiva, he had put up in Israel, he put up a poster of Michael Jordan. And then he slept Romanian every day. One day the rabbi comes in, says, "Who's the Schwarz on your wall?" And he rips it down. He left. He said, "I don't." And so for some time, especially when he puts off the college, he created a distance. That's, I would say, the conscientious objectives. Obviously, there are other factors. For some, they are swayed by the academic secular environment of the classroom. They internalize the challenges that are issued from documentary hypothesis, philosophy, scientism, etc. What I found is that this is really a very minority group, and
for these students in particular, the intellectual challenges don't lead them necessarily to stop observing, and certainly don't lead them to distance themselves from the community. What it, in other words, the network that students come in, and by and large, the Orthodox communities, the way they're set up, are so comfortable for students, it takes a lot more than just a question to prompt them to leave. Let me give you an example. A student once came to me, this is right in the beginning, I just finished Smicha and Revel, and I was like, so part of me was very excited to like take on the questions, the documents, the hypothesis in science and religion, etc. Finally, a student comes to me and says, Rabbi, you'll never believe what my professor taught in class. We have to sit down and have a talk. The Torah wasn't written by God. I'm like, great, let's get together. So she comes in. Now, I just set up my office. I had a picture of Michelle up and my baby daughter who was just born. And she comes in, we sit down. She says, so I said, tell me what they said. She says, well, he was saying that there were four different sources of the Torah. And then she stops. She says, that was that picture of your wife? I'm like, yeah. She says, she's so cute, so wonderful. I say, yeah, but tell me more about what he said. So he says, yeah, and then they were written at different times. Is that your baby daughter? I said, yeah, you're so cute. I said, yeah. And then I said, well, continue. She says, Rabbi, I'm so glad we had this talk. I feel so much better. And what I realized is that what she needed was the ritual of having spoken to the rabbi about it. But it's okay to live with questions. And so this is, like, I think, a great example. That's what I learned early on, is that it's not the intellectual question, per se, which are going to drive someone away. For someone to be a conscientious objector, that's path number one, usually it involves some kind of prior trauma with a rabbinic figure or some authoritative figure. That's the conscientious objector. But I would say within that category, sometimes there are people who come out of the closet, people who are gay or lesbian. I can speak to that for a long time. You can ask me a question to get some stories and some of my thoughts on that, but I'll just leave that for now. Second, the lonely men or lonely women of faith. What I found is that when people go to yeshiva in Israel, there's basically three groups. For half the people who go, they are, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. So they're in yeshiva, they're having a great time, it's a yeshiva environment, so they're going to minyan, they're learning what they need to learn or what the standard is in the particular yeshiva, and then they come back to the school, they do as the Romans do, and whatever's going on, kind of they go along with that. Then for a quarter of the people, they have a real life transformative experience. They are really changed. Whether it's people who were like the bad boys in high school, and all of a sudden like go through rehab and they're in yeshiva and like really turn their lives around, or people just become more mature and grow spiritually, but in a real life changing way. And then third are people, like I described to you before, who have just a negative experience, leave in the middle of the year, or like right after Pesach, or by the end of the year, but they're not taking anything in, and in fact, there's some damage, by and large. For the ones who had a real life-changing experience in yeshiva, when they come to college, there's something which is very interesting about their psychology, called their spiritual psychology. Part of their religious identity is not just observing strictly or being religious. Part of their religious identity is doing it because it's hard. In other words, feeling like they're doing it themselves even though no one else is. This came home to me once. A student asked me if he could go on a cruise with his parents. And I said, what's the problem? I want to go on the cruise. He said, no, but there's not going to be a minion on the cruise. Now, listen, how many cruises have minions? Now, how many vacation places do they go to have minions? The end of the world, you miss minion for a week? Not the end of the world. I didn't have a minion in Abu Dhabi. But I started thinking to myself, what's he actually asking? So I said, well, what concerns you? Because Rabbi, is it really important for me to have a minion? And my parents just don't understand. I realized he was looking for permission not to go. He was looking for permission. He wanted to show that he could do it. So there's a real process of individualization in those students. they know they're going to be doing something that's kind of not the regular. It's not the norm to be Shomer Negiya. It's not the norm to not study on Shabbos, for example, etc. They want to do things, but they want to make sure that they're doing it. And what happens is on most campuses, there aren't enough of these people to form a solid group. And here's why I call them the lonely men and women of faith. Because here's what happens, typically. Let's say at NYU we have about 100 freshmen who've come from Yeshiva High School or Yeshiva in Israel. So what happens is this. Let's say about 25 of them from the get-go are like minyan goers 3 times a day, etc. Like Shomer Negiya, wearing skirts, you know, like fits this out what you kind of imagine. But then what happens is that over the course of their freshman year, some of those, and those 25, let's say, are really 5 cliques of 5. Right, these 5 guys in the giant yeshiva together, these 5 people know each other from Scarsdale, and these 5 people, their families vacation together in Arizona. So they come in as cliques. But then what happens is that over the course of the year, statistically, like 2 or 3 of that clique will kind of like, they'll join one of the other groups. You understand? And so then, even though they came in as 25, and even though, let's say, there might be 10 of them left, they're not necessarily friends with each other. And so as their college years progress, they're not left with the same kind of group. Even though there are other people there that they can relate to, for some reason, because the social network hasn't been built like that, combined with the fact that to a certain extent, it feels good if the religiosity is hard, and if it's like, on me to do it, they end up kind of being a little bit more isolated. What tends to happen is that these people either get married, or in their junior and senior year, they feel a little bit lonely. Some of them, in my experience, let's say at NYU, just as an example, move up to Washington Heights so they can join their yeshiva buddies and keep a night seder and commute down to NYU. Things like this. That's the lonely men, lonely women of faith. I give a gemara shir, an even shir, 3 nights a week. So there are 5 or 6 people who come 3 nights a week from 9 to 10 at night. We're learning Zalman Basra, the third parak, gemara, rishonim, etc. I don't have 50 people in this year. I don't tell you. I'm just like small chav. And for them, it's with that kind of reinforcement is really important. But it's difficult. It is difficult. The third category, I would say, I think what I call them is the Orthodox bourgeois. They're primarily concerned with getting a good job. Now, in this way, they're not so different from most other college students. When we talk within the university kind of context about the new college experience, what's really being referred to is what people call the professionalized college experience. The image that many people have is like this liberal arts college with like grass, whatever. What's really happening now, more so than ever with this generation, is people just want a good job. They just want to get into like a good law school or a good medical school. Even though in some, and this depends on school to school, but by and large this is the case. There's been an overhaul of the college experience, which is much more professionally geared than it was before. The way these students behave is really consistent with that. What I started noticing is that these students pretty much behave like their parents. It's kind of scary. You know, the gabbai at Arminian, you know, I remember this is going back several years. He wanted things done a certain way. And I was like, well, I'm the rabbi. I think we should do it differently. He said, yeah, but this is the way it's done in my parents' shul. I'm like, yeah, but this is not the young Israel of Merit. But he's like, no, we've got to do things like our parents do them. And it's amazing to see this kind of behavior. And to a certain extent, I was like, whoa, they're a lot like their parents. And that's kind of an amazing thing, you know. You think about how much time you spend teaching your kids, modeling for your kids. They're like, oh, actually, they're really taking it. At that point, I realized, college, no college, is that the dominant influence on the way a person will grow up in terms of their religiosity is the home. That's dominant influence. And by and large, the values of making money, giving tzedakah, supporting our Orthodox communal infrastructure, these pretty much are the values by which they operate. Going to every minyan, going to all the shiurim, not touching girls or boys, those are like the details. But
But in terms of the, maybe Teaneck might be an exception to a little bit more observant here than many of the places that I see. But by and large, those are the values by which they operate. Think about it like this. This really got me. If I compared the way these students are acting in college, the way their parents acted in college, the kids are probably more religious. They're probably more religious. They're more educated, Jewishly. But it's pretty similar. So here's the psychology of it. My wife is getting her doctorate in psychology. She's a developmental psychologist. She's studying something they call emerging adulthood, which is this. Anybody ever hear that term before, emerging adulthood? Well, here's what happens. Here's the new life stage. What psychologists started realizing is the impact of a postponed date of or projected date of marriage. That nowadays the people are getting married, I mean, different for men and for women by a few years, but in their either in the late 20s or their early 30s. People now have their 20s to explore, experiment, and what psychologists and sociologists started realizing is that as opposed to a generation or two ago, when people transitioned from being a kid to being a grown-up around the time that they graduated from college, or whenever they got married, which tended to be in their low 20s, nowadays people are taking much longer to transition. And if you ask someone who's 26 if they feel like they're an adult, by and large the answer that you'll get is kind of. People very often describe themselves as being in transition. If anybody here has children in their mid-20s, how many of them are financially independent? You don't have to raise your hand. But there's no longer the expectation that by the time someone leaves home, or by the time someone gets married, or even by the time someone has kids, if they're in their mid-20s, they're not expected to be financially independent. So what the literature says is that this period of a person's life has all the privileges of adulthood, but very few of the responsibility. It's very self-indulgent. This is what my wife said. She's comparing our community, the Orthodox community, where the age of marriage tends to be lower than the general population, with kind of the norm in American society. So here's what my wife observed. She said, what is it about the Orthodox students that propels them in a certain direction? And then she started realizing two years after working at NYU primarily with the Orthodox students, I became the rabbi of the Hillel, and I started getting to know the students from a Reform conservative or just Jewish background, and I was able to make some kind of comparison. Here's what happens. When people get to college, because it's such a radical break from what they were used to before, whether they went to yeshiva in Israel or whether they're coming from yeshiva high school, what they do is they apply the templates which they're familiar with to the college setting. Here's what happens religiously. What are the religious models for kids? Well, there's their shul, there's their high school, there's their yeshiva, there's their camp or NCSY or Snekiva, their informal educational framework, and then there's their home. And what they do is they seek to create programming or to find resources in the university which will satisfy each of these requirements, so to speak, to provide continuity for them. So for example, you know, when there's a whole group of students who came back from yeshiva, so they have to have a tish on Friday night. And here was the things they were looking to create. They wanted a tish on Friday night, they wanted a gemara b'ilin shir, and they wanted advar lacha after davening, and time when the Beis Medrash was set aside for a Beis Medrash hour. That's what they wanted. They're seeking to recreate the yeshiva experience. For many students, they come into, say NYU has, there's a lot of Hebrew Judaic studies classes offered, they come and they assume, well, I'm going to take Hebrew over this, because they're used to this idea of a dual curriculum. That even from high school, even in their academic life, they're looking to have, you know, their secular and their Jewish subjects, and so on and so forth. And the home also, you know, that's part of why we host people in our own home. because there isn't a parent, there isn't their siblings or nieces and nephews. They want to be in that environment also. You know, Chabad Rabbi at NYU does a great job at this. You walk in Chabad, it feels like you're living. And that's another thing that they're looking for. The big difference, here's the point. The big difference between the Orthodox students and the non-Orthodox students is that the Orthodox students are used to having Judaism happen in an institutionalized setting. They're comfortable in their shul at home. They're used to being in a high school cafeteria. For most non-Orthodox students who come, their only comfortable experience of Judaism has been in their home. And so the first time they walk into a Hillel building, they're like, this is not really me. You know, because there's more than six people there. Like, this is not really me. Where's my couch? Where's my bubby? Where's my chicken? You know, chicken soup, matzo ball soup. It feels very alienating because they're not used to it. But that's what's happening on a collective basis. This is what I observe. Is the Orthodox students who are coming are seeking to recreate those things that they're familiar with. Now, it's interesting. There are some things they don't have templates for. They don't have a template for how do I interact with someone who's Reform or conservative. Or in many cases, how do I interact with someone who's not Jewish? They're not equipped. That's partly the unique job that I found myself in, is how do I relate to people? Even if, let's say, they were taught something intellectually or academically. But putting into practice is much more difficult. So what have we done so far? I described to you what most JLIC rabbis do. I described to you some trends in spirituality among Orthodox students, the conscientious objectors, the lonely men and women of faith, and the Orthodox bourgeois. Some people call them the ortho-chic, because they like being Orthodox, but also like they like nice things, you know. Okay. And then I discussed with you the five templates that Orthodox students tend to apply to their college environment in seeking to work on it. Let me share just two last points, and then I'll take some questions. How are we doing so far, by the way? Okay? You doing okay?
Yeah.
For those of you who didn't get a chance to nap on Shabbos, I hope this is a good opportunity. What's the difference between a, let me do it like this. I notice I also have my recommendations for making decisions. Okay. Two last points. Over the past 2-3 years, besides for being the rabbi of the Orthodox community, the rabbi of the Hillel, I'm also become a chaplain for the university. What that means is that I represent the Jewish student interest to the university and get involved in these like meta questions, policies. The university's putting up a center for spiritual life, which is going to have spaces for different religious groups. I was involved in the architectural planning and et cetera, things like that. That's why I went with university personnel to Abu Dhabi. Obviously, it's somewhat controversial for Jewish students at the university that there's going to be one branch of the university, which is in a country that's not recognized by the state, so it exists. I had a good time. I mean, I could probably tell you more about the Sheraton in Abu Dhabi than about Abu Dhabi itself. But I wore my kippah everywhere, and it's pretty comfortable. But the last thing, and this has been more in my capacity as university chaplain, is the opportunities to work with other faiths has a really unique impact on Orthodox students. NYU is a very large university. It's about 20,000 undergraduate students, one of the largest private universities in the United States, if not the largest. The largest club on campus, the largest regular gathering of students on campus is Friday Night Davening. It's Friday Night Davening. In many ways, the kind of community and motivation, wholesomeness, commitment to education, lishma, that the Orthodox students exhibit is a model within the university. It's not just at NYU, it's in other places also. The community, the way those students apply the templates to the campus environment is actually exceptional. The universities know this. they appreciate the Orthodox. There are some universities which build a kosher cafeteria with the hope that Orthodox students will come. They love that. They love that. So I'll just give you one example of the impact that some Orthodox students have on the campus community as a whole. There's an earthquake in Haiti. So I send that over our list, we're going to be having an emergency meeting. About 50 students come, I would say about 3/4 of them are Orthodox. We decide, okay, you know, we're going to hold a vigil. So we form a subcommittee out of those 50, there's 6 students, and they say, okay, we go on and contact everybody on campus. So this person is in charge of reaching out to the religious clubs, the Hindus, the Muslims, the Arabs, the Christians, the Catholics, etc. This one is in charge of all the political clubs, the Democrats, the Republicans, the leftists, etc. This one is in charge of all the cultural clubs, the Chicken and Rice Club, the Milk and Cookies Club, etc., etc. So what happens? They spend a week flyering, Facebooking, negotiating, networking, bringing as many of these people together as possible. And the interesting thing is that they wanted to take credit for it. And I said to them, if you make this into a Jewish event, no one else is going to want to come. And so they said, okay, we understand, Rabbi. So what if they negotiated with the head of the university senate, student university senate, and it was going to be a university senate program, and they contacted the president of the university who agreed to come, even though he was going to Abu Dhabi the next day, and they got the Stern School of Business to donate their space and AV equipment, and they brought out 250 people. They got and 2 students who were from Haiti spoke about their experiences, their family, their intentions to go back, and how proud they are to be Haitian, etc. It's amazing. You know, and I look out over the crowd, who's there? Say it was about a half people who were wearing kippahs or, you know, part of the community. And then there's everything. Then there's Haitian, there's Hindu, there's... But what was amazing to me, so proud, is that it was the Orthodox students who took the lead. They understand how to put these things together. They're used to having, like, a Yom HaShoah assembly, Yom HaShoah thing. They're used to doing this. They understand the value of community. You take it for granted. But most students don't understand the value of community in the same way our students do. And so there's real unique opportunities. Let me say a few words about as you're making decisions to where your son or daughter should go, what some considerations should be. I mentioned right at the beginning, I'm a proud alumnus of the Yeshiva University, and I'm gonna be I'm gonna call him as I see him. Actually, I'm an alumnus of Yeshiva University, thanks to my professor. I just wanna say thank you. It was 15 years ago, right? 15, 20 years ago, Mr. Kanzler came to Gush, sat down with me and said, we want to make it possible for you to go to YU. It wasn't on the map for me then at all. I wouldn't be here today if Mr. Kanzler hadn't encouraged me to come. I wasn't even considering it. So I owe you a great thank. I don't think I ever thanked you before this, but I owe you a tremendous amount. The way I see it is that if there's YU, there is a campus experience which is kind of far from the city, or any city. It's kind of like off on their own. And then there are urban campuses. You could include NYU, Queens, etc. Now here are some of the challenges and benefits, I think, of each place. It goes without saying, someone wants a religious environment, a holy religious environment, there is no parallel. They are not going to be able to find that in the same way other than Yeshiva University. The dorm experience, for sure. The balance of Limudei Kodesh and the secular studies, for sure. The number of people there are available to speak to get to know, the sense of chevra, you can't compare. If a gentleman wants to spend 5-6 hours a day learning, not going to be able to do that in any other school, pretty much, unless it's like Yachid Bedoro. But by and large, it's not going to happen. So for a guy who's committed to learning that amount of time,
There's no question. There just aren't the resources anywhere else. My Gemara here is not as good as Rabbi Sobolovsky. Promise. Promise. If a student feels like that kind of environment would feel too claustrophobic, then here are the challenges or advantages of others. In a campus school, like, you know, the University of Maryland, such where they're like off and it's just the campus, the advantage is that there's like a strong sense of school spirit, there's a great sense of community, because the architecture of the landscaping is given to that. In an urban school, you don't have that same sense. You know, it's difficult to speak of NYU's campus, where like there are buildings and then there's other buildings in between. It's much, much more difficult. And that kind of urban experience can be lonely. Same time, universities which are major research institutions or which are embedded in cities provide more in terms of professional development, both research opportunities as well as internships. I think the data at NYU is, I think one out of two students have jobs as they're in school. That obviously, to some extent, diminishes from their college experience because they're not in it in the same way, but it does offer them professional development opportunities. As to like specific schools, if you ask me, I could probably say a word or two about them, but I won't right now. The last thing I would speak to is parenting. It's how you parent your children while they're in school. And I have to say here, I'm a tweener in terms of my age. I'm between, you know, parent's age and the student's age. So I haven't gone through it, so I can't tell you. The one thing that I could say is that students really look up to you. They are looking for your guidance, for your support, and they're looking for you to be non-judgmental. That's true. Let me take a few questions, and then we'll see where we go. Questions. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to take like five or six questions, and then I'm going to try to put them together. Yes.
You spoke about it to some extent, but I'm curious as to the experience of the students of different levels of Jewish background.
Yes.
And how you relate them and they relate to you.
Students from different backgrounds. Good. Yeah, let's get a whole bunch here. Let's get them going. Yeah, come on. High school preparation. Okay, very good. High school's prepared. Good. Good question. Yeah. Yeah. Good, good question. Involvement of bourgeois. Okay, good. Yeah, in the back. What's your name, by the way?
When I think back, I don't know about you, but when I think about my friends who went to secular colleges, I think a lot of them fell into the category by 12, like reflective doc, where they were kind of orthodox, but they could eat traits, they eat apples, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then eventually after they graduated, they kind of got back, you know, fully on the therapy, things like that.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, they kind of didn't lose that in particular category, where that kind of fit in.
That's the bourgeois. Yeah. If at any point in time a person's going to be, at any point during a person's life that they're likely to be least religious, it's in their 20s, when they're single. Once you start having kids, you're like, oh my God, this is serious. You know, I have to start getting a little bit more serious. But yeah, this is the time when they're going to lapse a little bit. And this is the trend not just for the Orthodox community. Across the board, people become more religious once they start having a family. And the emerging adulthood period is the least religious of all. Yes.
You referred several times to parenting.
Parenting.
So I'm curious, in the course of your observation, do you tell child parenting?
Ooh. Okay, that's a good question. That's a really good question. Yeah, let's take like two or three more. Yeah.
Which
Twersky is this?
High
Okay, I'll address that. Okay, good. Yes. Anybody else have a hand up? Yes.
So how do you and your wife get to know the vast majority of kids from NYU, the Orthodox and the thousands really? So how do you connect to them and get them involved instead of students? Like, who seeks who out?
Okay, good question. Who seeks who out? Okay, I'm going to do like one-liners for these, and then if you have any follow-up questions, we'll take the follow-up questions. What time is it? Oh, yes.
The owner on the wife question is sort of skirt around, but take the proposition, which is not this proposition, which is that if you want your kids to remain religious and Orthodox, then you should make sure you're going to
So why you as panacea? So good. As insurance. No, that's good. That's good. Insurance. Okay, any last initial questions? So we'll do two rounds. Let me put up some one-liners, and then if you have follow-up, we'll take a follow-up. You might not have follow-up. Okay, let's start with gay and lesbian. Gay and lesbian. So I didn't want you to just like phrase itself. I didn't want you to get an office of gay, lesbian, transgender questioning services. Right, bisexual, thank you. So they have this phrase, gay by May, because it usually takes about a year, you know, freshman year, for a person to feel like, okay, this is something I can do. That is accurate. It usually takes about a year for a person to start, who is gay, to start thinking about how they're gonna come out, or it's safe for me to tell anybody. Am I sure? But basically, their first year in college is, if they are gay, that's a really critical year and a dangerous year. It's a very, very dangerous time. Very dangerous time. Here's typically the way I've seen it happen. Every year, there's one or two students, let's say at NYU, who I work with, who are in this kind of position. And sometimes the catalyst, when someone feels like they need to come out, is when they find themselves, in a strange way, in a relationship with someone. And they don't plan for it, but it just kind of happens. And then they have all these kinds of, their time is split between like their friends from yeshiva and their new set of friends they've made. And that creates kind of a bifurcation of self, which is only sustainable for a limited amount of time. And then inevitably someone notices something, or they feel like, how can I go on like this and not tell some of my friends? Typically, they'll inform like a few close friends first, who they feel very safe telling that they're not going to be rejected, and then they'll eventually, within a short amount of time, come to their parents. The time when someone is coming out is, I can't even describe to you how risky, dangerous, on edge, depression-filled it is. So, so hard. At that point in a person's life, that's also when they have the rate percentage or rate of suicide is also much higher. That's why my approach to this issue, when we're speaking about college students, not kind of much later in life in the community, we're talking about college students, it's so important to be supportive. I really feel it's a matter of the growth methods. I really believe that. I've known students who've committed suicide, unfortunately. So, and I've like been in the hospital room with them when they've died, and it's just, it's so touchy and it's so sensitive. I think any kind of condemnation or kind of act of unsupport is a very, very great mistake. Not having nothing to do with halacha, just having to do with initiative to growth nefesh. Any attribution, my experience has been is that they're not looking to, the students who do come out, they're not looking to hurt the Orthodox community. They're not, many of them have actually had positive experiences in their coming out, where they feel like when they told their parents were supportive, or when they've told different people, that different. Sometimes it's not the case. There's one guy who comes from the Syrian community, whose mother discovered an essay that he wrote in his freshman year, talking about his struggle. Didn't show the father because she was worried that the father would kick him out, and hadn't told his father even after he graduated college. Can you imagine? It's very, very, very touchy, very sensitive. But by and large, within our community, we've, I think, both friends, friends and kind of parents, confidants have been supportive, thankfully. Okay.
Just one short follow-up.
Yes. You know, let me, can I, is it okay if I hear all the questions and then we'll do the follow-up in a second? Actually, you organized it, I think.
I'm not coming back.
So you go ahead.
I'm just curious whether you think a student who goes to NYU as opposed to YU is more likely to come out at an NYU type of institution
than
YU?
No one who was raised Orthodox would choose to be gay. It's not the kind of thing that happens under peer pressure. People know what it means. That's why it's so traumatic. They know that their dreams they've had their whole life of having a family are not going to happen. They know that they're never going to be totally accepted by their family or extended family. They know that there are going to be some friends who aren't going to talk to them again. No one would choose to do that. No one would choose. So I don't think it matters whether it's I don't think being gay is not contagious. It's important to say. It's not contagious. It's not like if you touch someone who's gay, it's not that way. It's not that way. It could be that people are predisposed. Look, NYU is like the gay university. It's like 60% female, and then of the 40% of the men who are left, it's like a larger than usual percentage. It's right in Greenwich Village. So it's something I'm particularly sensitive to, and there may be some students who, on a subconscious level, are making that decision. But, okay. Jews from different backgrounds. I find great accessibility to students from different Jewish backgrounds. The fact that I'm modern Orthodox is a great selling point. It's a great selling point. People can't tell when they first meet me whether I'm conservative or Orthodox. They don't know because I'm open. That most people, Orthodox is like what their great grandfather was. You know what I'm saying? Or their grandfather who didn't talk to them. Or some wacko uncle who became Baal Teshuva, didn't come to their simchas. They never met someone like me. I mean, I haven't gone to YU for smicha. I was like, borrowed. I didn't even realize what kind of cachet it is. It's great cachet. It's great. But the fact that I do have a strong background, I know Gemara, I know how to learn. People feel that when they're speaking to me, they're getting kind of a knowledgeable response. So I don't feel that kind of distance. Do high schools prepare students well? The bulk of preparation that high schools give students has to do with Israel and Israel advocacy. They do a very, very good job. They prepare them to go out and be ambassadors for Israel. There's something else which the high schools are not necessarily training students to do, which is to form relationships with people who would otherwise be anti-Israel. That sometimes is more effective in messaging than like coming out and knowing how to do a rally or write an op-ed. I go around to different yeshivas sometimes and I say this. There's a fish I've been to, so that's the only one that invites me. Ramaz. No, I've been to different places. And I try to present this message. But I think both are important. When it comes to issues of like the intellectual challenge, documentary hypothesis, I think it's so different when you're studying in an environment where it's like, okay guys, here's like the challenge that you're going to hear and here's your response. Then when you're actually in a classroom and everybody else believes it and you're like the one guy who doesn't. That experience is very difficult to prepare someone for that experience. The next question was the weekly involvement of the bourgeois. Think about like in most communities, how many adults are involved on a regular basis in the shul's activities? Whatever the answer to that question is the answer that you have to your question. You know, for many parents, they're working these like 10 to 12 hour days plus commuting, and they don't have time so much to go to shul. I mean, there are some who do, and that's wonderful, but by and large, shul is like a week by week thing, and that's what you see many students doing. In a Catholic school where there's a cafeteria, people are eating kosher, so they see each other, but they're not necessarily like involved. Many, if their parents, if they've seen their parents be involved in shul on committees, etc., then most likely they'll want to take on a leadership role also, and that will give them increased involvement. I had a question. What was the parenting question? The parenting question. Who asked it? Parenting. Yes.
I was just curious how when a student comes to you or you meet them.
Can I tell how they've been parenting? Sometimes students describe their relationship with their parents in the most glorious terms, to be honest. Sometimes they say, you know what? I have conversations with my mother late at night on Friday nights, or we go get our nails done together, and that's amazing. Or, you know, I learned with my father. It's what you'd expect. Some, very often, kids will tell me, but they don't tell their parents, and I make a point of picking up the phone and calling the parent and saying, you should know what kind of impact you've had on your son or daughter. They really appreciate all those hours. But just because you put a lot of time into your son or daughter, they're not necessarily going to tell you, but very often they will tell me. Very often they will tell me. Rabbi Twersky, is a genius, and we, our generation owes him tremendous, debt. I don't know what his interaction is with kind of the rank and file Orthodox students. Judging from my conversations with the 14 other JLIC couples, it seems to be that it's not like when someone goes to secular college, they're kind of like drifting. Depends which college. Maybe he teaches at the University of Pittsburgh or something like that. Right, where's he teach?
He wasn't Pittsburgh.
He lives around the corner. Oh, I mean, he is one of a kind, But his experience might be limited. Maybe he was speaking about 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I don't know. But certainly in the... So maybe he's seeing something that I'm not seeing. In the Orthodox communities where there are hundreds, let's say NYU, Maryland, Columbia, etc., it doesn't seem... I mean, you go show up on a Friday night. There are hundreds of people there on Friday night, davening dinner. It doesn't seem to me to be the case. How do we get to know people? How do Michelle and I get to know people? We invite people into our home. We give shurim. We go on our coffee dates. We hang out in the cafeteria. We do programs. We do everything that we can to catch like 10 minutes with a person. We make eye contact. We listen to them. They listen to us. And they feel like they have a connection. What we found, just because there are hundreds, we tried to work on the efficiency model. So I hired a student part-time to Facebook friends, everybody in the Orthodox community. And then they felt, then when I walked around town, they say, hey, Rabbi, thanks for friending me. I'm like, great. But that opens up a channel of communication. Also, when I speak on Friday night, there's usually 200, 250 people there. And what I try to do is show myself to be open, available, wanting to meet with students of office hours. Because of the volume of hiring other people to help, so we're going to get students from Yeshiva University and from Hove and from HUC and from JTS. And we have a staff of 10 full-time people. So we're working on many different levels. But I try to make, and Shabbos, I'm out 24 hours. I'm like davening, hanging out at dinner, we have a program, we have a tish. And the next day, davening, lunch, mincha, shal shittis, and the camp star Havdalah. So I'm like on Shabbos because that's when the students are most around. That's when I make myself available. Is YU a panacea? Is it good insurance? Look, I mean, I think it's hard to say that anything is a panacea. Are there in terms of like certain levels of observance? You know, yes, there are things that a person is in YU and his roommate is going to Minyan. And there are many more people at YU who people go to Minyan for shopping. So it's more likely that they'll be going to Minyan. Is it a guarantee? I don't think anybody would say that's a guarantee. But that's not how I would sell YU. Maybe Mr. Kansas could tell me different. I wouldn't want to sell YU as a panacea. It's a safe haven. So if you want to be sure, then you come here. Because that makes it sound like it's a safe haven. I would want to sell YU. It's like, it's a great learning opportunity. You know, I worked so hard at YU when I was there. The fusion of Torah, like having 8 hours of learning and then 8 hours of, you know, Shiva. We were on the same floor together. But we worked hard. Had a good time also. But like, it was, you know, we worked hard. We got tremendous. So that's the way I was going to sell YU, not as a safety. I don't think there is such a thing as a safety. Okay. Any follow-up questions? Yes. You. Okay. Yes.
I have found that you've been doing a huge homework and now it's time to attend to you. And I am really very concerned that he's going to, for one thing, why you should where he wants to go.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking that eighth grade, now they're all girls that he's never sat in class with. And maybe they're Jewish, a lot of them are not, but they're his friends, they're his study partners, relationships develop. How as a parent do you just say, okay, I'm going to close my eyes and hope and pray that the last 12 years that I gave him are going to sustain him? I'm scared.
I think it's, that's completely natural. What I don't have any experience in is at the moment when you are going to let go, there is going to be a moment where may not be his relationship with the other sex, might be his financial independence, might be the age at which he decides to have a child, might be the number of children he has, might be, you know, which school he decides to send his children. There's going to come a time when you are going to let go. Look, there are dozens of people from NYU who are down at NYU for Shabbos and for Shabbos regularly, and that's like the most social time. So, and there's like a New York City network, just like there's a high school scene, there's a college scene, and if someone is looking for that, they'll find it. I mean, I share your concern. I don't, obviously at Yeshiva University's campus, there are no girls. You know, if you're looking for safety in terms of that, it's more likely that, but there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee. Yes?
I'm curious about the influence.
Sorry, most people at NYU are not Sherman and Gear. Most people are not Sherman and Gear. But if he goes to NYU, doesn't get married, and then moves to the West Side, is he going to be Sherman and Gear? It's hard. These are hard things. Yes?
Is there movement among the students to a different orientation to Yiddishkeit? Kids who came in with little background or acquiring background are becoming more assertive. There are probably kids who come from Yeshiva who are moving away from it. What kind of movement is there?
That's a good question. There's, you know, David mentioned earlier, so I teach these 10-week courses, and you have about 200 students every year. And some of them, I would say about 5% of them, decide to really kind of become religious fully. For many of them, this prompts a journey not necessarily of becoming Orthodox, but of learning a lot more and benefiting that way. So that's kind of, you know, what I would say. It's around, I wouldn't say that there are thousands every year joining the ranks, but definitely significant numbers. Okay, well, thank you very much for this opportunity. It's been such a pleasure, and I hope we can see each other again.
Thank you.
Take care.
Let me just take an opportunity to thank Rabbi Steinle for coming down and to remind you that this Friday night we have a tish that will take place at Zichron Mordechai, which is Rabbi Talbot's shul down the street, at 8 o'clock. And it'll feature Rabbi Dr. Tversky with Dr. Eli Kranzler. It should be a very interesting evening. Good food, good music, good Torah. So please join us at 8 o'clock. Of course.
Great. Yeah, I do think it's better.